Hi, my name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic. And I was hoping it would take more time so I could just speak about 5 or 10 minutes. Not the case. I want to welcome all the newcomers that have under 30 days. And I'm going to tell you what they told me, you know. Hang on to your ass because you're in for a hell of a ride. You know, and that's true. You know, I came in here, you know, I was bankrupt in every area, you know, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, physically, every area of my life, you know. And I couldn't see a way out, you know. I went to 7 different hospitals, recovery hospitals, and I tried every single form, and it didn't work, you know. Sheikh Shadle in Seattle, you know, they give you as much as you want to drink to get you sick so that you won't, you know, want to drink anymore, you know. They put you in a room, they sit you down, there's all kinds of bottles around the room, and they ask you what's your favorite. And mine was Crown Royal, you know. I was the one that changed from Scotch to Crown Royal, you know, because I went to a party and I saw all these people, you know, drinking Crown Royal, and boy, they were really cool, you know. They weren't getting out of line. They were just, you know, maintaining and everything. And I, in my head, says, that's what the problem is. I need to drink Crown Royal, you know. So I started buying Crown Royal, you know. And it didn't work. You know, a couple of weeks later, I was in the same spot, a little bit worse, you know. But, you know, I came from a loving family, you know. My mom and dad, you know, my dad could quit any time. He'd have a couple of shots of tequila, you know, and go to bed and get up in the morning, go to work, and it wouldn't affect him, you know. And I remember my real first drink that I took. I was 13 years old, and it was a Cinco de Mayo celebration, and there was a dance, and there was people having fun and just dancing, and a friend of mine comes up to me and says, "Hey, come here." You know, it was a bottle of wine. It was sweet. I think it was port, you know. And he said, "Have a drink of this," you know. And I took a drink of that, you know, and it went down real warm, and it felt good. And the taste didn't matter as much as the feeling it gave me, you know. It gave me that feeling that, like, the ingredients that was missing in my life, I had it now, you know. I went out there, and I had the courage to talk to the girls, and I had the courage to get out on the dance floor and dance, and boy, I mean, I just partied, you know. And you know, normally, without the alcohol, I always felt like the square peg and I was trying to fit in a round hole, you know. I always felt less than. I could see the other kids in school, you know, they would just, you know, get into a group and talk and get together and laugh and make jokes and I couldn't fit in there. I mean, so I became a loner, you know. I mean, I just, you know, went through junior high school and high school as a loner, you know. And something happened to me when I was 8 years old that I became real angry, and I carried that anger, you know, all through my life until I became sober, you know. And that anger took me to learning how to defend myself and take care of myself, you know. And I started exercising, you know. They had this comic books, you know, they have those ads, you know, Atlas, you know, Hole in the World, you know, and Joe Whittier, you know, doing push-ups and building your muscles, and I sent for all of that, you know, and I started getting really fit, you know. By the time I was 14, 15, I was really, and then I started taking self-defense lessons, because there was a guy that gave self-defense. So, you know, I learned karate, and I'm not karate, judo, and a little bit of jiu-jitsu, you know. And so by the time I was 17, I was in a lot of trouble because I had two assault and batteries already, you know. And I got into some real trouble because, you know, Fats Domino, I was in San Jose, and Fats Domino came to play, you know, and saying, boy, it was a big deal. And I went, you know, and I got to drinking, and some guy told me not to dance with the girl I was dancing with because it was his girlfriend. So I told her, you know, and she says, no, I broke up with him a long time ago. And he should have never said no, you know, because, you know, us alcoholics, you know, once they tell us we can't do something, you know, we go ahead and do it. So I went and I asked her to dance, and she comes up. What he did first is threw a bottle at me, and he missed me, you know, and hit somebody behind me. And that guy grabbed a bottle and threw it back at him. And by the time he knew it, boy, there was bottles flying all over the place, and big old riot started, you know. And one of the police officers that knew me, you know, grabbed me and said, you started this. And I said, no, I didn't. No, he was trying to handcuff me, and some other police officers called him that they needed help, so he took off. By that time, you know, they were looking for me already, you know. And they found me, you know. They went to school, picked me up, took me in. Two detectives, you know, and they asked me, you know, they said, you know, you started that big riot, didn't you? I said, no, I didn't. I was still, they said, well, we have witnesses saying that you did start it, you know. And they said, you already have two offenses against you. We're going to give you an alternative. Either you go in the service, or we're going to make sure that the judge sends you to CYA. And I said, well, I'll go in the service. As I was walking out the door, one of them says, if you think you're so tough, try the Marines, you know. So I tried the Marines, you know. And I went in the Marines, and I never forget they took us to San Diego, and they put us in a barracks. They were waiting for a whole platoon to form. So they put us in this Quonset huts, you know, and as soon as we got there, they had us clean the bathrooms, and about 11 o'clock at night, they turned the lights off in bedtime, you know. And I was sleeping really good, and all of a sudden I hear this big old clanging, you know, and the light turns on. It was a DI comes in, and he throws one of those metal garbage cans right down the aisle, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and he said, okay, girls, it's time to get up, you know. And I knew that that was a mistake. I said, maybe I should have gone to CYA, you know. Maybe they sleep till noon or something, you know. And I went through the Marine Corps basic training, boot camp, and then basic training, and then advanced training. Advanced training was in the Pathfinders, you know. They teach you how to jump out of airplanes, you know. And one of the things that they told me in AA, you know, they said, if you jump out of an airplane, you don't have your parachute on, you know, you'll die. And that's the same thing in AA, you know, if you don't do, you know, it's a must, you know, a must that we, you know, do the things that they suggest around here. A suggestion is just a subtle command. You know, if you jump out of the airplane and they suggest that you pull that D-ring, you know, so that you won't die. You know, it's the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. They make a lot of suggestions around here, you know. And in the beginning, I had a lot of problems with the suggestions, you know, because I was defiant, you know. I always wanted to do it my way, you know. But anyway, I got out of the Marine Corps, and you know, the normal thing that, you know, society expects, you know, hey, you know, you meet somebody, you get married, you have kids, and you live happily ever after. And I did, you know, I got married. I think at the end of my service, I was communicating with a lady that I married, and she was a really fine, nice lady, you know. And we got married, we had kids, you know, everything, you know, on time, you know. I had a big capacity for drinking, you know. I could drink 2 fifths of tequila and still, you know, maintain and go to work in the morning, you know, and do the things I needed to do, my responsibilities, you know. But, you know, alcoholism is a progressive disease, and it progresses, you know. And it progressed, and I kept on drinking and drinking, and pretty soon my wife, you know, tells me, you know, you better do something about your drinking, you know. By that time, I was arguing with her, staying out late, you know, and not doing anything with my kids, you know. And I remember every time I went to work by then, I would think all week, you know, I said, do you know what? I'm going to take my kids, you know, to Santa Cruz this weekend. I'm going to, you know, take them here and do this with them. And I wanted to do those things, you know. And the weekend would come around, Friday night would come around, and somebody at work would bring a couple of cases of beer and we'd start drinking. And then somebody would say, hey, let's go to the bar, you know. And, well, I was ready, you know. We'd end up at, I'd end up at the bar. And, you know, most of the guys would go home, like, you know, to their wives and wherever they had to be, you know. Not me, you know. I'd stay until they closed the bar. And then the next morning I would be so hungover that I couldn't do anything. The kids would come up, you know, to our bedroom and Dad, you said we were going to go somewhere. Oh, I don't feel good, you know. And I did that a number of times, you know. And I just couldn't do it anymore, you know. Get up. I was going to, you know, cure myself, you know, drink a beer, you know. And it wouldn't be, you know, my intentions were to just have a beer so I could get going. Well, by that time, I would overshoot the goal every time, you know. I'd have one beer, then another one. Then it wasn't enough, you know. I had to have some whiskey, you know, or tequila, you know. And then my ex-wife told me, you know, she says, you better do something about your drinking. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous. They came over. They took me to a meeting. And the meeting was a meeting like this. It was a speaker's meeting. It was at the Downtown Fellowship in San Jose. And right in the middle of town where all the winos were, you know. And I started seeing some people, you know. The thing that I remember about that meeting is that the people had smiles on their faces and they were genuine. They had a glow in their eyes and they were actually laughing and they were happy and they were talking to each other and they were making sense, you know, because by that time I didn't make sense at all, you know. The only thing I could think about is, where am I going to get the next drink? You know. Well, we sat down. The speaker started talking. And he talked about how he'd gotten out of prison about 6 months ago. You know, and by the time he got out of prison, you know, he had lost his family. And I was sitting there listening to him, and my head's telling me, well, I've never been to prison, you know. I still have my family. I still have my business. And you know, every time he said something, I would say, well, you know, and then I thought, you know, I said, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. So I told the guy, one of the guys, I said, I'm going to go to the bathroom. So I went to the back of the room, went in the bathroom, and there was a back door. Walked out the back door. Guess where I went? First bar that I found, you know. And I stayed there until they closed. Then I went home. I called the cab. But anyway, see, what I was doing is I was listening to the differences instead of the similarities, you know. Every time that guy said something happened to him, see, because I still had my family, I still had my business, and I still had my, you know, my house. I still had everything, you know. And, but I was listening to the differences, you know. So, you know, I continued doing what I was doing, you know. And finally, it got to the point where it got so bad that I used to pride myself that I never hit my wife, you know. And one day I hit her. And the next day I felt sick and ashamed and embarrassed, you know. Because I had never done that, you know. She had a purple face, you know, on this side, you know, and a black eye, you know. And then the time, you know, I patted myself in the back because I said, I'm going to leave, you know. And I left. And you know, and in the beginning of my sobriety, I would say, you know, yeah, I did it because, you know, I wanted to save them. You know, actually, I did it because I couldn't handle the responsibility anymore of being a husband, a father, you know, maintaining everything that I had, and I couldn't, you know, so I left. That time I had by that time I had gotten my contractor's license, and I used that contractor's license like a thief uses a gun to rob people. I was always on the edge of getting it suspended. I'd take money from people, you know, and not do the job, you know, or do a half-assed job, you know. See, God always working in my life, you know. I learned that after I came to this program, you know. Because the man that was running the contractor's board in San Jose was an alcoholic like me, you know. So he always used to, you know, cover for me, you know. I'd bring him, you know, a couple of fifths of whiskey, you know, and say, oh, you know, hey, you know what, this job was okay, you know. And actually what he was doing is he was enabling me to do more, you know. And I was always on the edge of the contractor's board, you know, suspending or revoking my license, you know. But they never did, you know. Anyway, 8 years later, after that first meeting that I went to in 1970, 8 years later, everything that man had gone through, I had gone through and more, you know. Actually, they never sent him to the mental hospital, you know. I had two moments of clarity in my life, you know, and one of them was by that time I was not having hangovers, I was having blackouts, you know, because there's three the stages of alcoholism is a hangover, a blackout, DTs, and then a wet brain, you know. And I was at the blackout stage, you know. I remember, you know, being with one set of people over here in this bar and drinking and sitting there laughing and carrying on and everything, and then I would black out, and then I remember being with another set of people somewhere else, you know, and it went on and on, you know. And by that time, you know, I had closed the business, and I had some, and I was living on receivables, you know, that I had. Contractors owed me a lot of money. But, you know, I remember coming to one day, and I'm pounding my head on the wall, and the wall is padded, and I'm in a straitjacket. And that was one of my moments of clarity. Said, what the hell am I doing here? You know, what happened that I ended up here? You know, and that was, I was in the Santa Clara County Jail, psychic war, something like that, mental war, I don't know. But from there, they took me in, they took me in front of a judge, and the judge says, you know, you're gonna go to Agnes State Hospital. You know, and that's where I ended up. And, you know, I was in there about 2-3 days, and then the cobwebs started clearing up in my head, and I started looking around. And that was one of the most scariest feelings of my life, you know, because I started seeing the real nuts, you know, the way they were acting, and it scared the hell out of me, you know. And I run up to the door, you know, and they had a little window like this, and I'm tapping on it and tapping on it and tapping on it. And the nurse comes up and says, what do you want? I said, I don't belong here. I don't belong here. She says, of course not. Neither the CE, nor VM, nor her, you know. None of them belong. None of you guys belong here, you know. And boy, it scared me, you know. And finally, you know, I started seeing a psychiatrist, you know. And the psychiatrist was trying to, for me to tell him that I had maybe a drinking problem. But every time he asked me, do you drink a lot? No, a couple of beers a day, you know. Yeah, I never told him I drank maybe a couple of quarts of whiskey a day, or, you know. But that's why we drive psychiatrists crazy, you know, because we never tell them the truth. And how can they help us, you know? But anyway, you know, they finally let me out of there, you know. But you'd think that would make me stop. No, I continued. This was around January of 1978, you know. And, you know, I drank all the way, you know, off and on, you know, and I found myself in different places, you know. And I found myself in places I didn't want to be with people I didn't want to be with. And just because they were drinking, I was there, you know. I was a bar drinker. And I lived in bars, you know, and I used to have the first couple of times that I started speaking, you know, I always glorified my drinking, you know. I always talk about how many fights I got in, how many women I went with, how many, you know, I mean, I was just used to glorify it, you know. The truth of the matter is that I was just a drunk, you know. I was just a helpless drunk that I ended up, one morning I woke up and I could hear voices. And I wake up and I look up and there's, you know, and in San Jose, there's St. James Park, and there's a statue of St. James. Well, I was laying there, and I looked up, and I was looking up at the statue. And the voices that I heard were people walking by going to work. You know, they had their suits and everything, and I'm laying there, you know. And there's a couple of winos laying on this side and another one over here. And I'm there with the winos, you know. That was another moment of clarity in my life, you know. That's when I asked myself again, how did I get here? What am I doing here? But you see, what we do... See, I started drinking at the top of the mart in San Francisco, you know, because I was running a company in San Francisco. And we used to go and drink at the Fairmont, top of the mart, and, you know, high class and everything. And what happens to us is as the drinking progresses, we seek lower companionship, you know. We start going with the people that we feel comfortable with. I didn't feel comfortable anymore with the people that drank in this, you know, lounges, you know, that had fireplaces. And you know, I'd go where the, you know, where the bums went to drink, you know. One of the low-class bars, you know. And my ego would, you know, explode when I walked in the bar and the winos would say, here comes Al. You know, yeah, give them all a drink, you know. made me feel good, you know, because I was already seeking lower companionship. But anyway, in November, Thanksgiving Eve of 1978, I called my ex-wife and said, you know, it's Thanksgiving. It's going to be Thanksgiving tomorrow. Can a couple of the kids come over, you know? And she was so angry at me, you know. She said, you're never going to see the kids again. I'm going to move and take them with me, and I'm going to change their name. You don't deserve to see them. And see, I did a lot of damage to my family and my kids, you know. I hurt them a lot emotionally, you know. I used to pat myself in the back because I said, well, I never spanked my kids, you know, but I did a lot of emotional damage, you know. But anyway, that was a good reason to drink, you know. I started drinking again, you know. By that time, I was going in and out of AA, you know. I'd get 30 days and I'd get 60 days, you know, and here and there. And that was only because my probation officer, you know, was tired of, picking me up at bars. See, God always put people in my life that I needed. I found out later that he was in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he would try to help me, wear the two hats, you know, PO, and try to help me, you know. And he would pick me up at a bar, take me to a detox center or something, you know. And finally, he got tired, and one day I went to see him, and he gives me a phone number, and he says, Al, I'm going to give you a phone number, and I want you to call this man every single day, and if you miss calling him one day, I'm going to violate your probation. So I called him every day. See, I'm calling you, Ed, because my probation officer told me to call you. Yeah. Well, it went like that, you know. It went on from about April, you know, until, you know, the Thanksgiving Eve, you know. I started my last drunk Thanksgiving Eve till the 23rd of December. And it was the most hopeless drunk that I ever had, you know. See, the last 3 years of my drinking was nothing but a total nightmare, you know. Every time I drank, I would end up in the hospital, in jail, or somewhere I didn't know where I was at, you know. But anyway, I drank until December 23rd, and I wanted to die, you know. I was inside the apartment all that time, and see, God always worked in my life, you know. I lived in an apartment downstairs, and there was an alley in the back, and there was a couple of boards off the fence, and I would go through the fence, across the alley, and it was the back of a liquor store where I had an account, you know. I'd go in there, get me about 4 half pints of Crown Royal, come back, and drink, you know. See, I was buying half pints because I was cutting down, you know. But I drink those 4 half pints in about an hour and a half, you know. I go back and get some more. And it got to the point, you know, I don't know if a lot of you have gone through this, but it got to the point where I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober, you know. It was just a total nightmare, you know. It says in the big book that there's a time when we see the 4 horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And that's where I was at, you know. And I was paranoid, and I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober. I was just in that stage where I wanted to die, you know. And I started hollering out and screaming, God, help me. God, help me. And I got on my knees on the side of my bed, and I put my head on my arms, you know. And I was crying. I was crying like a baby. And I stayed like that for about, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour. And and then all of a sudden, I started feeling this warm feeling in my gut. And it felt good. And it felt warm. And then I raised my head, and everything looked bright. You know, like somebody had turned a light on, but there was no light. You know, I had the drapes shut and everything, but everything was bright, you know. And then I got up, and I looked around, and everything was bright. I walked into the living room, and everything was bright, you know. And all of a sudden, I hear this voice, I don't know if it was inside my head or if it was out here somewhere, but I heard the voice. It said, everything's going to be okay, you know. And suddenly I realized that I wasn't drunk anymore, you know. So I got on the phone and I called my sponsor. Well, he wasn't my sponsor yet, but the man that I kept calling, you know. I said, Ed. I said, and I told him what happened, you know. He said, Al, he says, you had a spiritual experience. He said, hang on to it. Don't let go, you know. And you know what? Ever since that day, I've been walking towards the sunshine, you know. Things have been good for me. I really believe that God intervened in my life, and I really believe that if we ask God sincerely to help us, God will help us, you know. Because I believe that God had his hand on me all the time, you know. Because there's things that I used to attribute to, well, it was luck. Or it was my knowledge, you know. And it's not that. Today I believe that God works in my life, you know, if I let him. And anyway, my sponsor says, I'm going to send 2 men over, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to have them stay with you. So they came over. The first thing they do is go through the cupboards, you know, see if there's any liquor, and they pour it all down the sink, and they pour my mouthwash down the sink, the aftershave lotion, everything, you know, anything that had alcohol. Anyway, the next day they stayed with me. They wanted to take me to a meeting, but I was too sick. The next day I started hurting, and I'm going through withdrawals, and I'm crying, and I'm begging. I need a drink, you know. And, oh, you're going to be okay. So they called my sponsor, because my sponsor sponsored them too, you know. So they called him, and he said that we could go get your beer. So they took off. You know, one of them took off. The other one stayed. And I was hurting. And then I remembered. I went in the bathroom. I told him I was going to go in the bathroom. I go in the bathroom. I locked the door. I reached way down the cupboard. I bottle of rubbing alcohol. I had a glass. I pour half water, and then I pour the rest of rubbing alcohol. Drank it, and I felt this warm feeling going down. And I'm standing there. Then by that time, the other guy has come. Hey, Al, got your beer here. And you know those alcoholics that hadn't drank for a while, boy, they smell good out there. And they start pounding on the door. Open the door. Open the door. And they knock the door down. By that time, I had passed out, you know. They rushed me to the hospital. I was in the hospital with an alcoholic coma for about a week and a half, 2 weeks. I woke up and I was angry because I knew I was going to go through that rat race again. I was going to get up and fight the same fight over again, you know. And then my sponsor came and he talked to me and, you know, he says, you know, God intervened in your life. And are you gonna continue your path? Because he will abandon you if you continue going your own way, you know. And he helped me, you know. And anyway, that was my last drink was a drink of rubbing alcohol. And I told my wife, you know, I said, you know, if I would have known that was my last drink, I would have gone to a bar, one of those lounges with a fireplace. I would have ordered a drink with a little umbrella, you know, and drank it, throw the glass against the fireplace, and, you know, that's it. That's my last drink. But it didn't happen that way. You know, I started going to meetings, and I was more serious about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was going to a lot of meetings because I wasn't working. First 2 weeks, I slept in my truck, you know, and I got a job, and you know, I finally started working. I got into the big book. You know, this big book here, you know, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a hopeless and seemingly state of mind and body, you know. And the purpose of this book, you know, I had a few brain cells burned out, you know, so I can't remember everything. It says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And, you know, my sponsor used to tell me, this big book, Al, has all the answers for living, for your life, you know. And the first 164 pages is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was around the program for a while, and I was dying inside. And not until I made a decision to get into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous did my life start changing. You know, once I started working the steps, I started experiencing some serenity and peace of mind in my life, you know. And I wanted more, you know. Once I started doing what was suggested, my life started changing. See, I always thought Alcoholics Anonymous was to come in here and stop drinking. You know, I could stop drinking anytime I wanted to, but I couldn't stay stopped. I always went back to drinking. I found out that Alcoholics Anonymous is to change my life so that I won't have to drink. And today, my life has changed 180 degrees where I keep walking towards the sunlight. You know, today God puts in my life everything I need, not everything I want, you know, because he looks at me and he looks at my wants and he says, you got to be kidding, you know, because our wants are never satisfied. And today I have a wife, you know, that's in Alcoholics Anonymous too. And you know what? She went to the nut house too. How can that be? How can two alcoholic nuts have such a happy life? You know, we've been married 22 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and 50 members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to our wedding, you know. I have less today in my life materially than I ever had when I was drinking. When I was drinking, I had everything I wanted and everything I needed. Today, I have a lot less. But you know what? The hole that I used to walk around with is filled. You know, we have a little 976 square foot mobile home in Yerington, Nevada. And I asked my wife, we had a chance to move into a bigger mobile home and a newer one and a real nice one. She says, I like it here. You know, we're blessed. We're blessed because we have all our needs met. You know, my sponsor told me one time, you know, Al, when you want something and your wheels start turning up here to make it happen, he says, drop it. Because, you know, God, allow God to make it happen. You know, if it doesn't happen, it's not God's will. If it happens, you know, it's God's will. And you know what? Every time that it happens, I ultimately find out that that's what I wanted. You know, God works in my life today. You know, I wouldn't trade the best years that I had, the best times that I had drinking for today, you know. And we moved to Yerington because Modesto was bad for her. She has COPD and she couldn't breathe anymore. I was having to call the emergency 2-3 times a month. And God put us in Yerington. Everything fell into place. We sold our house in Modesto, and at the same time we found one in Yerington. And the reason we moved where we live in our little mobile home is because we're close to the hospital. And I love that little town. You get 6 cars in the main street and it's a traffic jam, you know. and you know what? Our little newspaper, you know, it comes every Thursday, you know, and it has in color a print, you know, it says, the only newspaper in the world that gives a damn about Yerington, you know. And I just enjoy. I want to thank Bill here. Bill, I want to thank Bill for asking me to come over and speak. And you know, I used to travel really far for a drink. You know, today I don't mind traveling to come and share with you guys. And for the newcomers, you know, keep coming back. Keep coming back. Your life will change, and it will change for the best. You know, there's a lot of good stuff. I'm gonna read one thing. My book doesn't have it because it's an old book. But here's where my life is today. And I apologize for going over. But that's okay, because you guys work on your patience. Okay, it says, God willing, we members of AA may never have to deal with drinking, but we have to deal with sobriety every day. How do we do it? By learning through practicing the 12 steps and through sharing at meetings. How do we deal with the problems that we look to boost to solve back in our drinking days? For example, we're told in AA that we cannot afford resentments and self-pity. We learn to avoid this festering mental attitude. Similarly, we rid ourselves of guilt, remorse, as we clean out the garbage from the past through our minds, through the fourth and the fifth steps of our recovery program. We learn how to level out emotional swings that got us into trouble, both when we were up and when we were down. We are taught to differentiate between our wants, which are never satisfied, and our needs, which are always provided for. We cast off the burdens of the past and the anxieties of the future as we begin to live in the present one day at a time. We're granted the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, and thus lose quickness to anger and our sensitivity to criticism. Above all, we reject fantasizing and accept reality. The more I drank, the more I fantasized everything. I imagined getting even for hurts and rejections in my mind's eye. I played and replayed scenes in which I was plucked magically from the bar stool, where I stood nursing a drink and was instantly exalted to some position of power and prestige. I lived in a dream world. AA led me gently from this fantasizing to embrace reality with open arms, and I found it beautiful, for at last I was at peace with myself and with others and with God. Thank you.